Boccaccio, The Hunt, as depicted by Vivaldi in his Concerto for Violin in B-flat Major, the 10th of a set of concerti that formed Vivaldi's Opus 8, the set which included his 4 famous concerti describing spring, summer, autumn and winter, the so-called 4 seasons. Well, it was played there by the Everson Ensemble. The violinist directed the band, Pavlo Beznosiuk. Well, now, before our next visit to the BBC Proms, a word from an esteemed colleague.
Hi there, lovely listener. D-Love here and ready to share the love for digital radio on BBC Radio 3. Did you know that switching stations on a digital radio couldn't be easier? There's no fiddly tuning. It's all at the touch of a button. It's as smooth as listening to the sound of Mozart's 39th symphony. And that's pretty smooth. So tell your friends, tell your family, share the love.
If you love radio, go digital. For more information on switching to digital radio and on coverage in your area, search online for BBC Digital Radio.
This is BBC Radio 3. We are broadcasting on digital radio as well as high-definition sound online and 90 to 93 FM. Well, now we go back to the Royal Albert Hall to hear highlights of a Proms Plus Late event which was recorded last Thursday in the Elgar Room. It's presented by Georgia Mann.
Hello and welcome to tonight's Proms Plus Late, recorded, as always, under the purple-hued lights of the Royal Albert Hall's Elgar Room, where the famous red piano is gleaming as the night draws in outside. And we do have the perfect soundtrack for a sultry summer night for you this evening. Singing for us tonight is a vocalist whose voice has been praised for its natural, alluring purity and for its flawless pitch and lyrical expression. Not bad. Her name is Emily Dankworth, and although jazz is very much in her DNA, as you may have guessed from that surname, with her grandparents and father leaving a really indelible mark on the history of jazz, she has forged a unique sound which is very much her own, and we're very pleased to have her with us tonight. And she will be singing with a trio of talented graduates and soon-to-be graduates from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama's jazz course, which is where they all first met and where it is really at. We've got Nick Breakspear on double bass. On the ruby red piano is Liam Dunnicky, and Dave Ingemels is on drums. And over in the poet's corner this evening is Caleb Clasis, who had been named a Foyle Young Poet of the Year twice before he'd even started his undergraduate studies. I know, it's disgusting. And once he'd graduated, he set off for Texas to complete a master's, and that is where the poems in his first collection, Bottled Air, were born. And I think the arid landscapes and transatlantic commutes were actually working for him pretty well, because Bottled Air has since won the Melita Hume Poetry Prize for Best Debut Collection. Not bad going. And we will be hearing plenty of that critically acclaimed work from Caleb very soon. But first, starting things off for us this evening, it's the Emily Dankworth Quartet.
Winter is This is called Music. It's set in a children's home in Eastern Europe, and it's written in prose. One afternoon, we had them doing papier-mâché. Bowls of flour and water and piles of shredded newspaper were laid out across the table. We had spent the break getting dizzy blowing up balloons, so each child had one to cover in newspaper and paste. When the mixture was dry, the balloons could be popped to leave a hard shell. The room smelled like rising bread. Half-plastered balloons began bouncing around, twisting under uneven weight. A nurse wheeled in a girl we had not met before. Her large head was tilted forward and her back slightly arched in her chair. When her eyes flickered open, they were gluey white. She doesn't see and doesn't speak, they said. She is from another country and nobody here knows her language. There she sat. After a while, Joe decided he would do something. He filled a toilet roll tube with beads and sealed the ends. He curled her fingers around the instrument and shook it in both of their hands to make a sound. When he took away his hand, the instrument fell onto her lap. He picked it up and placed it back in her grip. This time, it stayed. Meanwhile, the rest of the room swelled. The nurses told us classical music was calming for them. Let's do that. Yes, this is what they want. This is great. Piano smoothing everything out, slowing everyone down. Everything all of a piece now. Voices folding into the music, making some sort of meaning. It doesn't matter what meaning. She is with us now, together in the music. A different dizziness, all safe, all well, all light. If you popped us, you'd be left with a single immaculate shell of light. Please turn it off, the nurse says. The children are getting upset.
Caleb, that first poem that we heard from you, Music, as you said before you read it, it has quite a prose feel. I mean, it feels quite novelistic, the way that you wrote it and the form of it. But I just wondered if, for you, do you have to have a story to tell in a poem? Do you start from a story?
Sometimes, but not always. I think I'd sort of classify a poem as anything that kind of places language under some kind of duress. So that could be a narrative in form, or it could be simply a kind of compressed language.
So for you, the whole form thing can be very fluid. You don't need to be talking about a stanza here and an octet here. And
much more fluid than I think people would usually kind of accept poetry to be, something with line breaks, whereas I don't think it...
It doesn't have to be. Yeah. Tell us about what we're going to hear next. It's another poem from you now.
This poem begins with a story of some Russians who fled their home in the 20s after the revolution and found themselves in some ancient Buddhist caves in northwest China. And nobody knows what happens after that. They seem to disappear, but the only trace they left was in the graffiti on the caves. So this is Emigrants Deface the Caves. After the British, the French, and the Russian collectors, more Russians made it to the Mogao Caves. Emigrants sent there by Chinese bureaucrats who didn't know what else to do with them. They had left together because they were unwanted, not because they were friends. Half had stopped talking to the other half, who slept in the upper caves in shifts. In one cave, a smiling statue is dressed in robes, painted with pictures of rooms in which men sit cross-legged, facing statues dressed in men in rooms pattern, the surface repeated, revealed, inside itself, and so on, like gossip. The emigrants wrote their names all over the statue, carved genitals into its mouth, and cut out its eyes. The kind of thing people do to find out where they are, my friend would say after biting his wife in his sleep. In my dream, I was in a house with no walls, he'd tell me, out getting his bearings in an open space on his own. He once woke under a desk on the 18th floor of an empty office block. The panicked guard sat him down in front of the security tapes, and they had silently watched nothing happen in silent grey rooms for an hour by the time my friend saw himself slip through the back door. Nobody had ever seen the cave behind the water. Please don't show it in your film, requested the elder tribesman. We would rather not pry where the swifts go. It is their place, not ours. The elder and the director shook hands. They understood one another. But how could he not take a camera through the falls just once, to turn on himself, to star in what wasn't really there? This is a love poem from Texas, and it's called The Glass Door. I haven't turned the computer on yet today to see how my life is doing, but breakfast was a success. I opened all the windows and all the doors to let in the air. John Donne believed, I think he really believed, that angels were air and wore air, wore it down upwards towards their impossible purity. Then a friend emailed saying angels no longer believe they are real. No feather stirs, no dust. No other air imprints the air. Let him teach me that nothing, goes a different poem. I thought it was the right question. 2 days looking for nothing until I bounce my head off the glass door of being loved. Me and Skype know how excessive are real people. How over the top what is. And you much too replete in real time to warrant. I lags, you lags, love lovely glorious lags, and the air is full of hats, recording the wind as the priest, eyes down, reads his fond exaggerated phrases to a field of giggling.
Sozinho, cacho de vidro, o vida, o sol, a noite, o monte, um laço, um zoo, peroba no campo, de madeira, canga, candeia, machita pereira, madeira de vento, tambor de danceira, canga, candeia, machita pereira, vento ventando, tambor de danceira, fazer mátio, ofendo canseira.
Music performed by Emily Dankworth and her quartet at the Proms Plus event, late event that is, at the Royal Albert Hall last week. The poetry in the programme was written and read by Caleb Clasis, and the programme was introduced by Georgia Mann. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. In 10 minutes' time, we'll consider the pressures of administering justice in a country with a new constitution. Albie Sachs, a member of the ANC in South Africa, who was appointed by Nelson Mandela to be justice of South Africa's constitutional court, begins a series of essays this evening considering the work of that court in those early days and some of the difficult judgments he was called upon to make. Strange Justice is at 10:45 tonight. To take us there, music by Chopin, and played on one of his favourite pianos, not a bright, shiny red one, this, a little older. A set of brilliant variations played by Viviana Sofronitsky.
Thank you.
The sound of a copy of a Conrad Graf piano, the original built in around 1819 and said to be one of Chopin's favourite pianos. That was a set of Brilliant Variations, his opus 12 in B-flat major, played by Viviana Sofronitsky on that recording. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. In just over 50 minutes' time, tonight's and this week's edition of Jazz on 3. And tonight, Jazz Nelson will be introducing a tribute to the work of the saxophonist composer Wayne Shorter, who celebrated his 80th birthday yesterday. Jazz Nelson will be joined by Tris Clowes to select highlights from Shorter's performances with his current quartet, many of them recorded by Jazz on 3 over the past 12 years. Stay tuned for that. Jazz on 3 begins at 11 this evening here on Radio 3.
This weekend, Paris comes to the BBC Proms. Paavo Järvi conducts the Orchestre de Paris in Arvo Pärt's Cantus in Memory of Benjamin Britten. And Janine Jansen is the soloist in Britten's Meditative Violin Concerto. Plus two French showpieces in the second half, Berlioz's overture Le Corsaire and Saint-Saëns' Organ Symphony. From Estonian introspection to Gallic flamboyance, join Martin Handley at the Proms this Sunday evening from 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
And Martin will also be your host tomorrow night at the Proms. We'll be there to hear Andrew Davis conducting the Glyndebourne Festival Opera's semi-stage production of Britten's Billy Budd, based on Herman Melville's novella, telling the story of the young sailor who's persecuted by the predatory Master at Arms. That's all at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening at the Proms and here on BBC Radio 3. Well, now it's 10:45, time for the essay. Albie Sachs reflects on his work for the Constitutional Court of South Africa in this series. Having played an important part in drafting South Africa's post-apartheid constitution, he was to serve as a member of the court for 15 years. And tonight, he reflects on some of the early challenges they faced.
Nelson Mandela raised his tall frame. It was a crowded room. We were all very excited and expectant. And he said, "The last time I stood up in court was to find out if I was going to be hanged. Today I rise to inaugurate South Africa's first constitutional court." It was an extremely emotional moment, not just for the 11 of us about to be formally sworn in as judges of this new constitutional court, less than a year after those marvelous first democratic elections in South Africa, where black and white voted together as equals and constituted a new parliament, and the parliament chose Mandela to be the president, and now the president had appointed us after a very elaborate process of selection involving the Judicial Service Commission. Now we were going to be sworn in, and the next day to hear our first case. It was very, very special for all of us. Mandela, 27 years in jail, beaming, so proud of the moment. And many of us had worked with him in the underground. Others had defended him as counsel. Everybody appreciated his presence there. And how did we show our appreciation? About 6 months later, we struck down, exercising our powers as members of the Constitutional Court, two important proclamations which it issued. Not only were they important, but they were manifestly democratic. They dealt with the first non-racial local government elections ever held in South Africa. Black and white for the town councils, the village bodies and so on, would all vote as equals. And Parliament had said, we don't have time to pass the law in the way that we would like, Mr. President. Will you please go ahead and issue the proclamations? It was administrative. It was to ensure the security and the secrecy of the ballot, to provide the money, set up the stations and so on. And we struck it down. And we did so by a very clear majority on the basis that Parliament itself had to pass the law. Parliament couldn't abdicate its own legislative responsibility entrusted to it by the Constitution to the President. It could pass a law and then ask the President to fill in the details, but the primary legislation itself had to come from Parliament, a very fundamental principle of constitutionalism. And now, how would Nelson Mandela react? He went on television very, very quickly, and in his kind of considered, thoughtful way, acknowledged that the court had struck down the proclamation, said he'd acted on legal advice, which at the time he'd felt was correct, but now he fully accepted the decision of the Constitutional Court, fulfilling its responsibilities to interpret the Constitution, and he, as president, should be the first to uphold the Constitution as interpreted by the court. It was such a special moment, to my mind, equal to those marvelous hours where we all voted as equals for the first time. Because South Africa was not just a democracy, a non-racial democracy. South Africa was a constitutional democracy. All power had to be exercised in terms of this document, which over six difficult, tense, conflictual, but eventually triumphant years we had elaborated together. We South Africans had agreed this compact. This is the basis on which we wish to be ruled in future. Looking to the future, the court, the guardian of the processes and the values, the principles of the Constitution. And somehow he emerged with greater prestige, as if to say, and you see what a marvelous country I'm the president of. And people hadn't predicted anything like that. They'd said, oh, this is an ANC-dominated court. They'll never go against the government. I'd spent my whole life in the ANC. I'd fought for the ANC, for the new constitution. But now I was a judge. I'd severed all my ties with the political organization. And it wasn't difficult for me because the very principles and values we'd been fighting for in the resistance, in the negotiations, through the election campaigns, were now embodied in this constitution. So it was a transition of modality, of functioning, but not a major transformation of beliefs. But the beliefs were now not just my personal beliefs, they were the beliefs incorporated in this document, held up to the world as a model of what a constitution should be. And now I was the guardian, one of the 11 guardians of the constitution on the court. That wasn't the first case that we heard involving Nelson Mandela. The very first case, in fact, was on February the 15th, that's the day, 1995, the day after we'd been inaugurated, sworn in, and it dealt with the constitutionality of capital punishment. 400 and more people were on death row. In the run-up to the adoption of the new constitution, there had been a moratorium on execution. South Africa used to execute 100 people a year. We were the leading country in the world as far as reported judicial executions were concerned. Was it now possible in the new democratic South Africa to carry on with capital punishment? And Nelson Mandela sent an old legal friend and colleague who defended him many times before, George Bizos, a great lawyer of Greek origin, to ask the court to strike down capital punishment, a body called the Legal Resources Center, which had formerly been set up by the now president of the court, who became Chief Justice of South Africa, Arthur Chaskalson, came in as acting on behalf of somebody on death row to argue for striking down the statutes which required or imposed permitted capital punishment. And the state was represented by the Attorney General of the province, then called the Transvaal, who argued on behalf of the state for retention, saying basically that capital punishment saved lives by deterring people from killing other people. The court was unanimous. Ordinarily, an issue like this might have been left to Parliament, but in the negotiations, we couldn't agree on whether there should be capital punishment. De Klerk, President De Klerk, then insisted you had to have it. Nelson Mandela, on behalf of the ANC, said no more capital punishment. It was decided to leave it to the Constitutional Court to make the ultimate decision. And now we made the decision unanimously, saying that capital punishment was incompatible with the values of our new constitution, which represented a radical rupture with the past being a society of repression, of intolerance, of division, and now a society that was caring, was interdependent, that respected human dignity. No longer would the state have the power to, in cold blood, execute people, however terrible their conduct had been. Capital punishment was now outlawed by the Constitutional Court. And I might mention that when the Constitution was finalized 2 years later, we were at that stage acting under an interim constitution, Parliament itself adopted the same Bill of Rights text that we had pronounced on in terms of saying that capital punishment was incompatible with the values of the new society. So in that sense, Parliament affirmed, in effect, the decision of the Constitutional Court. Our new constitutional democracy then had been launched with two very dramatic cases, both involving Nelson Mandela. And if he could accept the decisions of the court when they ruled against him, he was saying to everybody in our society, the postmaster general, the town clerk, the minister of justice, whoever it might be, this is the country we're living in. They shouldn't feel affronted personally. It wasn't something aimed at them or the party they represented. And the fact that I'd belonged to the ANC didn't make any difference at all. Not at all. We had been outlaws fighting against an unjust system to get democracy. Now we were part and parcel of the democracy we'd been fighting for with a special judicial responsibility. And I might say in my case, it was extremely rewarding to feel that after a lifetime of denouncing and being against the tours, against this, against that and the other, it was wonderful to be for something, to be healing, to be building, and to use the authority given to me and my colleagues in the Constitutional Court to nurture the new democracy we'd always envisaged. I wouldn't say the people went out into the streets to celebrate and dance with joy. More black people were opposed to capital punishment than white people in South Africa, but a majority were probably, if we went on statistical evidence, in favor of retaining capital punishment. But that's what a constitution is about. It's about deep, core, enduring values that have a coherence and a consistent consistency and represent the way humankind is evolving in terms of the protections that everybody's entitled to. And for us as judges, we were now involved in a totally different project from the functioning of the judiciary before. As somebody put it, we were moving from a culture of authority to a culture of justification. Before, it was simply, did Parliament say so? End of the matter. Interpret the words that Parliament used. Now we were saying, could Parliament say so? Is it consistent with these core values of our new democratic society? And if it didn't, then we must say that Parliament exceeded its powers. In this case, it was legislation from the old era that now had to be struck down because of incompatible with the values of the new era. In the small room, crowded, jam-packed with people in their finery, a special occasion, was the Speaker of the House, Reni Jhunjhunwala, and the Minister of Justice, Kubi Kutsi. He represented the old, she represented the new, of course, Nelson Mandela himself. And there we were, 11 of us, 9 men, 2 women. Some had been judges before, honest, decent, dignified judges with great experience. Others of us had been contesting the power. We'd been virtually outlaws, but now all united by the new constitution that South Africa had achieved. The first shall be the last shall be the first. South Africa was held up to the world as the polecat of the world, the country of overt discrimination. Now many people are drawing on the way we've responded to enhancing human dignity in what was such a divided, benighted, conflict-ridden society. We still have huge, huge problems in South Africa, but at least one can say we have a marvelous constitution and we have a very active constitutional court.
The essay was presented by Albie Sachs and produced by Mark Rickards, and it was first broadcast last June. And the essay is now available as a free download. You can go to the Radio 3 website and follow the link to find the podcast page.
Tone poems by Richard Strauss, Bantok and Sibelius, live from the BBC Proms. I'm Christopher Cook. Join me as Vladimir Yurovsky and the London Philharmonic Orchestra trace the development